There's a word that Paul uses in Philippians chapter 3 that your Bibles don't typically translate in a literal kind of way. The old King James does pretty close to it. It's a word that's translated rubbish or refuse or something like that. And it's a word that really has to do with dung and is probably not the most polite way of saying that word. I found myself this afternoon, in fact, in a conversation about that very thing, and it led to a discussion of the way the Bible talks sometimes, because the Bible is not always sensitive to politeness. God very often says things that are kind of crass and impolite to make a point. It's one thing, for example, to draw from the image of adultery and compare that to sin, because that's really the basic idea of breaking a covenant. But God doesn't just call His covenant-breaking people adulterers, He calls them prostitutes very often. And not just prostitutes, in Jeremiah He compares them to a donkey that's in heat and says there's not a hillside on which she's not been ravished. And it's even ruder than that in Ezekiel. And the point that I was making as I was discussing this afternoon is that this isn't really to give us, you know, license just to be crude when we want to be crude. But God does this sometimes to make a point, to shake us out of our complacency perhaps, to shock us into realizing the severity of whatever sin we are in. And it's not just language that is designed to shock us in this way, but very often judgment is meant to shock us in this way as well. If you turn to Deuteronomy chapter 28, you find the blessings and the cursings for the covenant that God made with His people. And the language here is very shocking, but it's even more shocking when you find the people actually doing this later on. But in Deuteronomy chapter 28, beginning in verse 53... Actually, picking up in verse 52, "They shall besiege you in all your towns until your high and fortified walls in which you trusted come down throughout all your land. And they shall besiege you in all your towns throughout all your land which the Lord your God has given you. And you shall eat the fruit of your womb, the flesh of your sons and daughters, whom the Lord your God has given you in the siege and in the distress with which your enemies shall distress you." The man who is the most tender and refined among you will begrudge food to his brother, to the wife he embraces, and to the last of the children whom he has left, so that he will not give to any of them any of the flesh of his children whom he is eating, because he has nothing left in the siege and in the distress with which the enemy shall distress you in all your towns. The most tender and refined woman among you, who would not venture to set the sole of her foot on the ground because she is so delicate and tender, will begrudge to the husband she embraces, to her son and to her daughter, her afterbirth that comes out from between her feet and her children whom she bears, because lacking everything she will eat them secretly in the siege and in the distress with which your enemy shall distress you in your towns." I don't know about you, but if I'm reading that section of text, and I have some kind of clue that this kind of judgment is coming upon me, that might shock me into realizing that perhaps I should change my ways, lest this fate befall me. But that's not at all what we see happening in the history of the people of Israel. And so we find ourselves, as we continue through the story of Elijah and Elisha, coming to the end of 2 Kings 6, and into chapter 7, where the Syrians have besieged the city of Samaria. And what we have progressively seen as we've looked through this section of the history of Israel is one judgment after another that God had pronounced on these people coming to pass, and yet they have not listened to a word of it. They've seen the power of God in the hands of Elijah and Elisha both. Both of these prophets have enacted specific judgments from the covenant. The famine. If you go all the way back to chapter 17 of 1 Kings, where all of this began, the famine, the drought, is a judgment of God for when they break the covenant. We talked in 2 Kings chapter 2 about how when these bears came out of the woods and ate the children, this is exactly what God had said would happen. If they do not turn back, wild beasts will come and bereave you of your children, God had said. And as that judgment continues to progress, they continue not to listen. And so we find them here under siege. And what we will find is that this is very much an upside-down kind of world, where things that you don't expect to happen do happen, where opposites find their way of working themselves out. And so we begin with the siege itself, beginning in verse 24 of 2 Kings chapter 6. Afterward, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, mustered his entire army and went up and besieged Samaria. And there was a great famine in Samaria as they besieged it, until a donkey's head was sold for 80 shekels of silver, and the fourth part of a cob of dung, a dove's dung, for 5 shekels of silver. Now the king of Israel was passing by on the wall. A woman cried out to him, saying, "Help, my lord, O king." And he said, "If the Lord will not help you, how shall I help you? From the threshing floor or from the winepress?" And the king asked her, "What is your trouble?" She answered, "This woman said to me, 'Give your son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow.' So we boiled my son and ate him. And on the next day I said to her, 'Give your son that we may eat him.' But she has hidden her son." When the king heard the words of the woman, he tore his clothes. Now he was passing by on the wall, and the people looked, and behold, he had sackcloth beneath on his body. And he said, "May God do so to me, and more also, if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on his shoulders today." Elisha was sitting in his house, and the elders were sitting with him. Now the king had dispatched a man from his presence, but before the messenger arrived, Elisha said to the elders, "Do you see how this murderer has sent to take off my head? Look, when the messenger comes, shut the door and hold the door fast against him. Is not the sound of his master's feet behind him?" And while he was still speaking with them, the messenger came down to him and said, "This trouble is from the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer?" But Elisha said, "Hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, 'Tomorrow, about this time, a seah of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel, and 2 seahs of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria.' Then the captain on whose hand the king leaned said to the man of God, 'If the Lord himself should make windows in heaven, could this thing be?' But he said, 'You shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat of it.'" Well, what we find as this story begins is Samaria under siege. And it is a picture of horror and hopelessness. To put it a little bit into its historical setting, you may remember that this is after something of a period of peace. Our last study ended in verse 23, after Elisha had brought the entire Syrian army, at least those who were raiding the land, into Samaria, fed them, and sent them back home. And verse 23 ends with the narrator telling us the Syrians did not come again on raids in the land of Israel. And so Elisha's provision of food had at least for a little while quelled this kind of guerrilla warfare tactics that the Syrians had been doing, raiding the nation. Now, after some period of time has passed, they pull out all the stops and wage total war on Israel. And this is going on during a famine. Notice it says in verse 26, "There was a great famine in Samaria as they besieged it." And it's possible that the siege and the war is what led to the famine. Another way of understanding this is to understand it as the famine being what prompts the king of Syria to bring this war. If you notice in chapter 8 in verse 1, in a different scene that we'll get to a little later on, we find Elisha talking to the Shunammite woman who we had met in a previous chapter, and he had told her that the Lord was going to bring a famine on the land, and so she needed to depart for a while. This famine would last for 7 years. And then what happens in chapter 8 is he goes on to tell the end of that story of what happens after the famine with regard to the Shunammite woman. Now, if this is looking far enough back in chapter 8, it's entirely possible, if not probable, that this is the same famine in chapter 8 that we find in chapter 6. And the famine is ending in chapter 7 when they find the food. What that all means is that this is the end of a 7-year-long famine that God had brought. And this is more judgment that God had brought in the form of a famine. That's what Elisha says clearly in chapter 8. This is a famine from the Lord. And so the famine's not a result of the siege, but it's the occasion, I think, for Ben-Hadad to muster his troops and invade Israel, because it is at their weakest point that he is doing this. And that might then also explain Jehoram's reaction to Elisha. We'll talk about that a little bit more in just a moment. But if Elisha has been going through Samaria preaching that this famine is judgment from the Lord, then there's every reason to expect a pagan, idolatrous king like Jehoram to want to chop off Elisha's head when it gets to its worst point. And that's really typical of the world's response to a righteous God. Shoot the messenger. I mean, you look through the history of the prophets, and it's a history of bloodshed. It's one prophet after another, to use Jesus' language, from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah. One prophet after another dies proclaiming the word of the Lord. He would rather Elisha be dead than to hear the call to repentance. But the siege itself is horrific in general, and a siege during a time of famine, especially at the end of a seven-year famine, would be even more horrific. And that's the nature of a siege in general. Basically, a siege, if you're not familiar with it, what they do is they surround a city and they cut off all essential supplies going into that city. Most significantly, food. And a siege is a war of patience. You sit outside the city and keep everything from going in until everyone inside either surrenders or starves to death. And that's what happens during a siege. It's a tactic of patience and starvation. And you find this same kind of language again over in Lamentations chapter 4, where here it's the siege of Jerusalem that is under discussion. But you find this language in regard to any siege, really. But in Lamentations 4, verses 9 and 10, happier were the victims of the sword than the victims of hunger, who wasted away, pierced by the lack of fruits of the field. The hands of compassionate women have boiled their own children. They became their food during the destruction of the daughter of my people. And it's, again, this picture of starvation and going to any extreme to find any food whatsoever. And it's better if you die by the sword, we're told there in Lamentations, than to endure the siege itself. And to give you something of an idea of how bad it was, it talks about the highly inflated prices of such delicacies as donkey heads and pigeon dung. So basically, there's nothing to eat. And you begin to see just how upside down the world is when you hear the complaint of this mother. It's an upside down world because of what she does in the first place. That this woman goes against all maternal instinct and instead eats her child. It's a chilling story. But as chilling as the story is, her request is even more chilling. She doesn't go to the king to present a case against her murderous friend. What she does is she goes to the king and asks him to permit another murder of this woman, other woman's child. She seems completely oblivious to the fact that she has committed an abominable crime. And what she does is she just opens up and publicly states exactly what she's done with no shame whatsoever, and assumes that the king is going to take her side. That she's absolutely right in what she has done, and her terrible friend has done a horrible thing. And I guess, you know, in sense of fairness, maybe you could come to something of a conclusion of that. But in reality, really? This woman expects the king to see that as some kind of justice? And there's a sense in which I guess you could say this woman is a symbol for Israel herself, who is devouring her children and bringing nothing but death to the land. And Jehoram sees this woman and hears this story, and he is completely helpless. There is nothing that he can do. And he says as much, I can't bring you either bread or wine. I can't help you from the wine press. I can't help you from the threshing floor. There's nothing I can provide for you. He knows enough to know that only God can deliver. Yet he seems to have no idea of where that deliverance can come from, where that salvation can come from. And he should have a pretty good hint, because the prophet that he's about to point at and say we need to kill him, Elisha, his name means my God saves. He ought to know exactly where salvation should come from. But instead, he wants to kill that prophet. And you see just how far down the road of Israelite history we've gone. You have at one end the wisest king who's ever lived, and he looks at a case between two women and their dispute over one dead child, and he knows exactly what to do, and with wisdom he answers the question. And now we have another king in a far worse situation, completely helpless to do anything about it. And instead of turning to the wisdom of God as Solomon had done, he wants to kill the prophet of God. He tears his garments. He's been wearing sackcloth, but there's absolutely nothing that can be done. And this idea of devouring one's children is a pretty common figure to make the point that the world has been turned upside down. In Micah chapter 3, for example, a couple of examples of this devouring children being used in a figurative sense. You find this kind of reversal surrounding this idea in Micah chapter 3, verses 1 through 3. And I said, "Hear you, heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know justice, you who hate the good and love the evil, who tear the skin from off my people, their flesh from off their bones, who eat the flesh of my people and flay their skin from off them, and break their bones in pieces and chop them up like meat in a pot, like flesh in a cauldron?" And what you find here, again, I think this is more figurative than it is literal, but these unjust, unrighteous people are characterized as tearing skin off the people, eating their flesh, chopping them up like meat in a pot. And what leads into this description is just how reversed the world is, just how upside down the world is. They hate good and love evil. It's an upside down world that they're in that leads to that kind of devouring of God's people. And you find the same thing in Isaiah chapter 3 as well, where this kind of, again, metaphorical picture, I think, of devouring people is surrounded and introduced by this just backwardsness of the world. And so in Isaiah chapter 3 and verse 12, "My people, infants are their oppressors, and women rule over them. Oh, my people, you guides misled you, and they have swallowed up the course of your path. The Lord has taken His place to condemn. He stands to judge peoples. The Lord will enter into judgment with the elders and the princes of His people. It is you who have devoured the vineyard. The spoil of the poor is in your houses." And so they've devoured the vineyard being the figure for God's people itself. They've swallowed up the course of your paths. And what leads to this but infants being oppressors and women being rulers? And if you go back even higher in the story in verse 4, "I will make boys their princes and infants shall rule over them." And again, this idea of devouring someone is framed within the context of the world being completely backwards and upside down. And now back in 2 Kings chapter 7, chapter 6, we find mothers eating their children. That is backwards and upside down. That is against all maternal instinct whatsoever. It is a reversal. And it's a reversal also of the covenant language. We saw in verses 53 through 57 of Deuteronomy chapter 28 a prediction of this very thing. But before that, in verse 4 and verse 11, God tells them that if they obey Him, they will be blessed, and the fruit of their womb will be blessed, and the fruit of their womb will be prosperous. But instead, the world is upside down, and they are being cursed instead of blessed. And what turned the world upside down is the people themselves. They are the ones who looked at this great Creator and said, "You know what? I think I'm going to cut down a tree and worship that instead. I think I'm going to build a nice rock formation and worship that instead." What led to this upside down world was the people's idolatry. They're following something that is not a god and calling it a god. And now they're receiving the benefit that such a god can provide, which is none. Death is all that it can provide. And so Jehoram's reaction is to, in essence, make a donkey out of Elisha. That's the other headless creature we read about here. I want to chop his head off next. Maybe we'll see what it can bring on the market is perhaps his idea. And you wonder sometimes what exactly is going on with Jehoram and Elisha. It seems earlier in this chapter that they have a nice, fine relationship where Jehoram requests something of Elisha, even going so far as to call him my father in a very respectful kind of way. But Elisha never has that respect for him. If you go back to the beginning of the story and remember in chapter 3, he tells him, you know, if it weren't for Jehoshaphat being here, I wouldn't even talk to you. Why don't you go follow those idols your parents followed and ask them for their advice? And he has been a pagan, wicked king all along, even if he's not a Baal worshiper like Ahab was. But his answer here is not that respectful tone that he had earlier in this chapter, but, again, shoot the messenger. Let's kill Elisha, and that will solve our problem. Or if it doesn't, at least we don't have to hear about this God of his anymore, maybe what he's thinking. And as you look at Jehoram's reaction, he can't help but remind you of his parents. He's different to some degree from Ahab and Jezebel because he's not a Baal worshiper like they were. But here he's very much like them. You remember Ahab really didn't say much when he talked to Elijah. He barely got a word out before Elijah would promptly put him in his place. But generally what he said to him was some not very kind epithet to describe how he saw Elijah. And he very often referred to him as something like, "You troubler of Israel." Well, you see, that's exactly what Jehoram thinks here. Elisha is the cause of our problem. He is the one who is troubling Israel, and so I'm going to kill him. He's followed in exactly the path of his father. He's followed the path of his mother as well. You may remember back in chapter 19, after the scene at Carmel, Jezebel says, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow. May the gods do to me and more also if I don't kill you by tomorrow." And how much does that echo in Jehoram's words when he says very much the same thing in verse 31, "May God do to me and more also if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on his shoulders today." And he takes his own oath to kill the prophet. But Elisha knows in advance that they're coming. Now the king is after him, and he takes precautions for himself. And in that conversation, he basically promises that by the next day, instead of Elisha being dead by the next day everything is going to be just fine. Everything is going to be back to normal. Society will resume its normal activities, and the captain who has brought the message to Elisha has no confidence whatsoever in Elisha's words. And Jehoram's impatience is matched by his officer's skepticism. Basically, what he says is that would take more than a miracle of manna-like proportions. If God opened up the windows of heaven, that wouldn't be enough to solve this problem that we're in. And Elisha says, no, it will be solved. There will be salvation for this people, but you're not going to participate in it. You're not going to get any of the salvation. And really what it boils down to is salvation for the people and judgment against the faithless. And that's not to say that the people suddenly had a great rush of faith, but God was being gracious to them and to the one who heard of God's grace and turned his nose up at it. God says, not for you. I'm giving you a great benefit that you do not deserve in this. And if you don't believe in it, well, you'll see it happen. It will be confirmed, but you're not going to get to participate in it. And what he'll find is it's the last thing that he's going to see. Well, how exactly does God go about solving this problem? How does this food come? As we continue in verse 3, "Now there were four men who were lepers at the entrance to the gate. And they said to one another, 'Why are we sitting here until we die? If we say, let us enter the city, the famine is in the city, and we shall die there. And if we sit here, we die also. So now come, let us go over to the camp of the Syrians. If they spare our lives, we shall live, and if they kill us, we shall but die.' So they arose at twilight to go into the camp of the Syrians. But when they came to the edge of the camp of the Syrians, behold, there was no one there. For the Lord had made the army of the Syrians hear the sound of chariots and of horses, the sound of a great army, So that they said to one another, "Behold, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Egypt to come against us." So they fled away in the twilight and abandoned their tents, their horses, and their donkeys, leaving the camp as it was, and fled for their lives. And when these lepers came to the edge of the camp, they went into a tent and ate and drank, and they carried off silver and gold and clothing and went and hid them. Then they came back and entered another tent and carried off things from it and went and hid them. Then they said to one another, We are not doing right. This is a day of good news. If we are silent and wait until the morning light, punishment will overtake us. Now therefore come, let us go and tell the king's household. So they came and called to the gatekeepers of the city and told them, "We came to the camp of the Syrians, and behold, there was no one to be seen or heard there, nothing but the horses tied and the donkeys tied and the tents as they were." Then the gatekeepers called out, and it was told within the king's household. And the king rose in the night and said to his servants, "I will tell you what the Syrians have done to us. They know that we are hungry. Therefore, they have gone out of the camp to hide themselves in the open country, thinking, 'When they come out of the city, we shall take them alive and get into the city.' And one of his servants said, 'Let some men take 5 of the remaining horses, seeing that those who are left here will fare like the whole multitude of Israel who have already perished. Let us send and see.' So they took 2 horsemen, and the king sent them after the army of the Syrians, saying, 'Go and see.' So they went after them as far as the Jordan, and behold, all the way was littered with garments and equipment that the Syrians had thrown away in their haste. And the messengers returned and told the king. Then the people went out and plundered the camp of the Syrians. So a seah of fine flour was sold for a shekel, and 2 seahs of barley for a shekel, according to the word of the Lord. Now the king had appointed the captain on whose hand he leaned to have charge of the gate. And the people trampled him in the gate so that he died, as the man of God had said when the king came down to him. For when the man of God had said to the king, 2 seahs of barley shall be sold for a shekel, and a seah of fine flour for a shekel about this time tomorrow in the gate of Samaria,' the captain had answered the man of God, 'If the Lord should himself make windows in heaven, such a thing could not be.' And he said, 'You shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat of it.' And so it happened to him, for the people trampled him in the gate, and he died." Well, this ending to the story is one that's filled with surprise and irony and all kinds of other fun things like that. You start with the lepers themselves, where they are there at the gate, and they take the best of all bad options. I mean, they're looking at their situation going, well, if we stay here, we're going to die. And if we go in there, we're going to die. And if we go out there, we're probably going to die. So let's go with the probably option instead of the certain options, and that's going to be our best bet. So they go out to the camp of the Syrians, and what they find is an empty camp. A camp where everything had been abandoned. And what you find is that God had deceived this army just like he deceived the army back in chapter 3, though he does so in reverse this time. That time, if you remember, he made the army of the enemies of Israel think that the camp would be empty, that they had gotten to a war with one another, the Israelites and the Judeans and the Edomites. They all fought with one another and they died, and so they came rushing on, the Moabites did, and they find, no, the camp is not empty, they're all here, and it's trouble for them. Well, in this case, he does the opposite. They think an army is coming when it's not actually coming, and they run for their lives and leave the camp deserted, even though nothing really is going on. And so they walk into the camp as unwitting victors of a war that they didn't even really have to fight. And their very first thought is a very selfish thought. They sound a whole lot like Achan and Gehazi, Elisha's servant. Their second thought is still kind of self-centered, but just in a less damaging way. We're going to be judged. Bad things are going to happen to us, so we better not do this. But really you see that their motive, I think, ultimately is a good motive. We are not doing right, they say. They realize they're doing something wrong and they want to correct that. This, they say, is a day of good news. We cannot keep this good news all to ourselves. And so they spread the news, and to make a long story short, the famine is solved. And there is a little bit of humor worked into this story. There's a couple of points of irony in this story. I mean, there's death everywhere you look. And again, the lepers are in this situation where if they stay where they are, they're going to die. If they go into the city, they're going to die. If they go to the Syrians, they're probably going to die. So they decide to try that. Which means that what leads to this situation of hope is the hopelessness that they were in to begin with. If it weren't for that abject hopelessness that they had, they wouldn't have really received the salvation that God had provided for them. And it leads also to a place where they were saved by their helplessness. They were saved by their surrender. And the nation of Israel were saved by those who are most helpless. I mean, think about this. The lepers are saving a city that by their own ritual laws they cannot enter. They're unclean. They can't go in there. And they're the ones who are saving these people. And the lepers are the ones feasting while the leader of the people of Israel gets trampled and dies. And there are a couple of, puns you might call them in here that's obscured by the translation because there's no good way to translate a pun in another language for the most part. But the word for leper sounds a whole lot like the word for Egyptian in Hebrew. And so you have the Syrian army panicking as they think the Egyptians are coming, but really it's just a handful of lepers scrounging for food. And how silly must they realize, perhaps eventually, they were, when what they thought was this great invading army was really nothing but a few lepers. And the Hebrew word for four lepers, it sounds a lot like the Hebrew word for windows. Remember, the captain said even if the windows were opened by God, it couldn't provide enough food. But really, it was just four little lepers who provided enough food for everybody to eat. And then there's the irony as well of this king who is huddling within the walls of his fortress, completely helpless to do anything. Meanwhile, four lepers lead an attack, I guess, on the Syrian camp and walk away victorious. And there is food for the people. The market stabilizes. The captain, who is stationed at the very gate where he anticipates seeing no trade whatsoever, is trampled in the scramble to get food. He has seen the salvation that he rejected. He has seen the salvation that he did not believe in. Because he had stood in God's way. He stood in the path of God's salvation, and he is trampled in a rush of judgment. Well, what do we learn as we look at this upside-down world that Jehoram and his citizens lived in? And as I often do with these Old Testament narratives, I'll largely leave it with you to think about and think through and see what you can come up with on your own. But let me suggest a couple of things as we wrap up this evening from this story. What leads to an upside-down world like this is sin. The world is turned upside down for us. Everything is opposite of the way that it should be when we refuse to be the people that we were created to be. As Tom has said before, the excuse "I'm only human" for sin is no excuse at all. Because God did not create us for sin. God created us for holiness. And the only truly human to ever live was Jesus. Because he is the only one who lived up to that standard. He's the only one who really lived the life without sin. And when we sin, when we reject God's message, we turn the world upside down a little bit. Because we put something else on the throne that God alone belongs on. Second, think of the deliverance that comes here. As the world is turned upside down, so to speak, God uses the least likely person to accomplish his purposes. I mean, who could there be that would be less likely to save all of God's people than a leper? Yet that's who God will use to accomplish his will, to bring about his salvation. who less likely to save the world than a condemned criminal hanging on a cross? Yet that's who God uses to accomplish His purposes and to save His world. And how do we participate in that deliverance? Well, it's not by going out and fighting a great war. It's by surrender. Just as these lepers ultimately won by surrender, that's what they were doing. Let's go surrender to the enemy. Our surrender is not to the enemy, but it is to the great captain that fights for us. We surrender ourselves to God. We surrender ourselves to Christ. And in so doing, we have victory. Not through anything great that we do or anything great that we accomplish, but through His great victory and participating in it. And finally, as you think about this story, you go back to where we began, which is the horror of deserved judgment. What these people experienced was what God had promised all along. God told them all the way back on the lips of Moses that you will be so sinful. If you follow that path, you will eat your children. But I will give you several stages of warning before that, and all you have to do is listen and repent, and that won't come upon you. Just listen and repent. And yet here we find them, in 2 Kings 6, not having listened to a word of it. God had given them every chance. God had tried to shock them into realizing how bad this was going to be, and they didn't listen to a word of it. If you think that judgment is bad, consider the judgment that awaits those who neglect the greater sacrifice and the greater salvation and the greater hope that is provided through Jesus. We've had every warning. We've had every chance. God has told us in shocking terms what it will be like. Eternal fire. Weeping and gnashing of teeth. And as we've talked about in the Sunday morning class, I think that just gives us a hint of how bad it's really going to be. To be separated from God. They didn't listen. The question is, will we listen? We can't do a thing about them. Their history is written, their fate is sealed. But we've been given every warning as well. We are given every chance. And so the question is, will we listen to God? Or will we eat our children, so to speak? Will we set the world right by worshiping God? Or will we leave the world upside down by serving only self? And we have an opportunity this evening, as we have an opportunity every moment we're alive, to make the world right, to turn our world right side up if we have not yet, by putting God in His proper place on the throne. And we take this opportunity to sing a song to encourage you to do that very thing, to make God the true center of your life, coming to Him for the first time or making your life right in some other way. But if there's any way that we can help you this evening, won't you come while we stand and sing?